Today on Lightning Bugs.
The main results, again, are around this concept called narrative transportation. This delicious experience. We all love it. We have it at a great concert. I went to see a stand-up comedian this weekend. We have it there. We have it when we read a novel. And we have it when we listen to an expert political narrative or a religious ideology or a conspiracy theory. All the expert storytellers do it. The more they're able to lull us into this state of narrative transportation, one, the better we like the story, and two, the more it sways us. The more, whatever the message is, audiences have high compliance with the messages in the story when they're under the influence of narrative transportation.
Hi, thank you for watching my podcast. If you've been enjoying the podcast, let us know how we're doing. Go to Lightning Bugs on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review with your thoughts. Or if you have any ideas for guests, we want to hear from you. So leave us that. Leave us your suggestions on Apple Podcast Reviews.
Jonathan Gottschall, PhD. He's a literary scholar and an author, probably a lot of other stuff too. Specializes in literature and evolution. He's a distinguished fellow in the English department of Washington Jefferson College in Pennsylvania. Graduate student in English at State University of New York at Binghamton, where he worked under the biologist David Sloan Wilson. I want to talk about that later. That's interesting to me. He's an author, right? He's written a lot of books. I'm going to go through a couple of them that we know about. The new one, Storytelling Animal, or newish one, Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human, The Literary Animal, Evolution and the Nature of Narrative, The Rape of Troy, Evolution, Violence, and the World of Homer. I almost said the World of Humor. Literature, Science, and a New Humanities. Evolution, Literature, and Film. There's so many of them. I'm not going to go down them all, but he's written so many and done so much that I thought I was going to be talking to like a really old dude. His work has been featured in New York Times, Scientific American, Mind, New Scientist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And his latest book, which I've gotten a chance to read ahead of its release, is The Story Paradox, and it'll be released on November 23rd, and it's fantastic. So it's an honor to welcome to Lightning Bugs, Jonathan Gottschall, PhD. How's it going?
It's going good. This is my first time like coming out from underneath the rock of like working on this book,
right?
And actually getting out and talking to people about it. So I've been a little nervous about it, and I've actually had a bad dream about this last night. And I'll just tell it to you because this is a story too, and it's sort of the demented, terrifying stories we often tell ourselves in dreams. So I got up in the morning to do the podcast, but we were doing it together. And at one point we had a plan of doing this in person, but before COVID ruined everything. And anyway, so you were like a visiting scholar at some fancy university. You were like a Princeton don, and you had like this little house they gave you right on campus.
I like the dream so far.
It was pretty great. I was a little jealous. But you were a really bad podcaster. You had like a cell phone that you're using to record it. You were kind of wandering all over the place, and I was very, very nervous. You kept trying to get me to eat flank steak during the interview, and gives you a sense of like this awkward move for a writer. I imagine as a musician, you have the same thing.
Oh yeah,
from the sort of solitary component, the writing component, and then moving toward a more public presentation.
Yeah.
Which is, for me, a lot more challenging. Because part of the reason you become a writer, and especially a scholar, is because you are completely comfortable spending your life, you know, in a classroom, in a quiet library, no hope of fame or fortune. You just want to be left alone, make some contribution to knowledge. So I wasn't really prepared for this sort of public side of being a writer. So if I mumble my way through things today, that'll be why, because of the nerves and the sleeplessness associated with my dream last night.
Well, you're off to a good start. I mean, the thing is when you release, like, you know, you release a record or a book, and I've done both now, you aren't prepared with the story of your story. You know, at some point you get your talking points down And so this means I stand to be able to eke just a little bit of honesty out of you before you get it.
That's
where you get your
true.
Story together.
That's
yeah,
absolutely that's true. The story of the story is really a great way of putting it. And I find it very difficult to condense, you know, books that run to hundreds of pages down to little consumable, you know, sound bites. And I won't be doing that.
It's impossible, you know, talking about what you've just done, especially since I find when I've released an album that the moment that I have to begin talking about it almost always coincides with the moment that I have the most doubt about what it is I just did.
Oh, absolutely.
And I blank on it at that moment. I'm like, if you ask me to name the songs on my album right after I finished it, and this would be an interesting question for a neurologist, is if I'm working on a song all day long, I go to bed, it's so present in my mind that I can hear the stereo image in it. I can smell the air around if there's horns. All this is so, I can't get it out of my head. I wake up in the morning and I can't access it. When I wake up in the morning, I can't tell you a single note of it. Something's happened and it's gone.
Huh. Yeah, I find that also. Another thing I think people don't know, probably about doing an album, also a book, is, you know, after you write the book, I spent 3 years, you know, researching, writing it, editing it, all that stuff. Mm. And then it just goes into a can for about a year.
Yeah.
And I don't think of it at all.
That's
right. And then suddenly, you know, October 11th comes around. I'm like, oh my God, I got to talk about this today. And I hardly remember what this book was about.
Well, and it doesn't really matter. Like for our purposes, I want everyone to read the book, so I'm going to keep saying it. But we don't have to necessarily concentrate on the book. I think what is kind of going to – could be a revelation – to some people, begins at your probably your first day of lecturing a certain literature course, where you're convincing your students of how much story we consume and live in, how much bumbling narrative we go from one thing to the next. And I'm just going to let you start there, because I believe that your average person, and you seem to believe this too, doesn't really understand how powerful stories are and how much we live in them. So I'm going to let you start basically at what's the beginning of a semester for you.
Sure. Yeah. So I try to convince the students, and I've been trying to convince my readers now for years of this, that human beings are Homo fictus, animals of story, as much as they are Homo sapiens, wise people. And in fact, nowadays we seem a lot more like story people, fiction people, than wise people. We're living right now in this sort of technologically driven, I call it a big bang of storytelling. Mm. This rapid expansion of the universe of stories in every direction. You are exploiting it right now as a podcast.
Right.
This medium didn't exist. We have Facebook. We have all the other social media. We have 24-hour cable news. I mean, and so, you know, when Nielsen gets into looking at the numbers and judging how much media human beings are consuming per day, the number they get to is about 12 hours a day we spend in media of various kinds, everything from popular songs to films, to our social media feeds and so forth. Not all of this counts as storytelling, but most most of it's narrative.
How is just a quick Instagram photo to you a story or a narrative?
Well, sometimes there's two ways of looking at this. One is just a little caveat. I am basically a conscientious objector to social media, so I'm not on it very much. I go browse around now and then. I read about it a lot, so I'm not necessarily the right person. Now, sometimes there's a photo on Instagram, and with it, there's a little story. I went with my friends to so-and-so, and we experienced such-and-such, and it's a story. Other times, you have basically people and brands on Instagram are doing something like, what is it called when like you publish an episode of your story, like Dickens, would publish an episode of a chapter of his story every week in the newspaper.
Right.
They have this episodic storytelling where the reader puts together, or the viewer puts together, right, the whole story, right, of this celebrity or this brand or this politician in their head.
So you see those as episodic, a dangling carrot for the next. And also gives you a lot of time to create your side, your version of the story, I suppose, as well.
Yeah. And one of the things that's kind of interesting research-wise is stories really sink in when audiences are allowed to do more of the work. Mm. So this whole wisdom of show, don't tell, which is the thing you would learn like the first day of creative writing class in college. Show, don't tell. If you don't spell things out, dramatize and leave things a little bit open-ended and allow the audience to do some of the creative work. When they do that, things really sink in. People remember the story better. And oftentimes, any meaning that the story conveys, any message that the story conveys, people have the sense that meaning or message was self-generated. They don't have this feeling that it was fed to them or forced upon them, even though it was. They feel like it was self-generated. So it's a powerful way of constructing a story.
I really think that if when people go out to buy your newest book, the Story Paradox, I think they should just go ahead. Hopefully they have a package where you can also buy the Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. Because I think for it to have the most impact, I feel like we need to know why it's so important to you to tell people why storytelling is such a big part of your story. because we're in so many stories at once that I actually think taking a step back and seeing how manipulatable we are, and why we live, what makes us tick, and how that's tied to stories is important.
Yeah, I do too. And this is the problem. You know, stories are precious. They do so many wonderful things. And that's mainly what I focused on, the Storytelling Animal, sort of the good side of storytelling.
Yeah, right.
But there's a dark side too, and it's been amplified in recent years, mainly by technologies that human beings did not evolve to coexist with, and you know, technologies that we have really a lot of difficulty coping with. And one of the problems with storytelling that gives them, again, all their power to do good is that the influence they wield is often invisible to us. We don't feel it. We're not skeptical of it. When somebody's telling us a story, we enter into this psychological state, and it's an authentically altered state of consciousness, like being drunk, like being high. You empty out, you're totally under the power of the storyteller. You pay rapt attention, oftentimes for hours on end. Nothing else in human life, no other stimulus can keep you tuned in for hours on end. And it's a state of high attention, but also a state of high suggestibility. So people are really open-minded when they're in storyland. That's a good thing. But it's a bad thing, too, because we're really gullible. We're easy to mold and to manipulate, not just by the good guys, but by the bad guys, too.
As a songwriter and a performer, I've always felt that people walk into a musical, they join the audience with their arms folded, and your first job is to create an environment where the arms are unfolded, so the story goes to the heart, you know, and that what I found when I was shilling my book, which was just a story of my life, was that people show up to these book readings, and you know, the Q&A sort of thing, the way they do to TED Talks, they show up really very willing to believe your world in a way that I found very uncomfortable. Like sometimes you'll do a book event in a bookstore, and maybe half the audience is yours. They've come. The other half is just the bookstore's following, people that were like back in the, you know, they were back in the literature section, and they come running up to just sit and see what you've got to say. I feel like as a musician And I'm sure a comedian feels this way too. They come folded armed. I feel like when people who are open to books show up, they're like, put me in your world, like a TED Talk. They just turn on TED Talk and whatever the person has to say about the world of narcissism or everything is the oceans or everything is the skies. They have a story that is everything. They come like I'm ready to be programmed or I'm ready to believe it. And I felt like when they walked out, they dumped it at the door. They're like, whatever he said, I don't care anymore. It's like, so I guess my very long question is then, because you've convinced me there's a science, a scienceable way to look at stories. Is there that moment or environment that can be traced in the brain or in our evolution where we unfold the arms?
Yeah. And so there's this sort of ancient superstition about art of all forms, but about storytelling in particular, that there's something so immaterial, so gauzy, so insubstantial, so spooky, basically, so spiritual, so non-physical, that it basically makes it science proof. It's proof against science. And this has been loudly proclaimed for a long time, but about 20 years ago, roughly, not exactly, but about 20 years ago, scientists started intruding into the territory of the arts and just started designing ingenious experiments. And one of the main areas that they were most interested in was just what you're talking about, this question of the altered state of consciousness that a story can lull us into and its effects upon us. Our story is just mindless escapism. For instance, is a song that you sing or a novel that I might read, is that just mindless escapism and we just drop it at the door as we walk out of the audience? We've had a nice time. Ben has entertained us for a while, but then we go up about our lives unshaped, unchanged. And your music was ultimately inert. Or is it really sinking in and really shaping us and changing us? And the main results, again, are around this concept called narrative transportation. And narrative transportation is just this delicious experience. We all love it. We have it at a great concert. I went to see a stand-up comedian this weekend. We have it there. We have it when we read a novel. And we have it when we listen to an expert political narrative or a religious ideology or a conspiracy theory like QAnon. And it's this delicious sensation of teleporting out of our own mundane realities and into these alternative story worlds. And the more a storyteller is able to do this, and singers do it, and conspiracy theorists do it, all the expert storytellers do it, the more they're able to lull us into this state of narrative transportation, one, the better we like the story. And two, the more it sways us, the more whatever the message is, the more, again, the word I use in the book is compliant.
Yeah.
Audiences have high compliance with the messages in the story when they're under the influence of narrative transportation. This makes it, again, very powerful for good and very dangerous.
Yeah. Because this podcast is to me for people who make things creative types of any kind, which I think is almost everybody. If you're creating and you're, say, a songwriter, how do you see I think very often a songwriter might not know that there's even a story inside the song that they're going to write. It's a mystery as of now. Now, when we're talking about it like this, it makes me feel as a songwriter like I've got some kind of master plan, and I'm trying to, I have to admit, like the first half of your book made me feel a little guilty for being a songwriter because it's like, okay, I'm trying to infect minds. Now, am I aware of that, or where does it, I think for someone writing, that might be a little bit of a daunting thing to think, oh, I don't even know if I have something to say.
Hmm. Yeah, that question of awareness, I think, is along a continuum. Some people, have a very strong, very clear, very canny plan to infect minds, indoctrinate people. Again, in good ways or bad ways, it's, you know, propaganda can be a black hat operation. It can be a white hat operation. I talk about that a little bit in the book. I imagine, though, this is something I haven't thought deeply about. I've tried my hand at novels. I'm in the process of finishing some off. I've been working on a couple and going back and forth between them and trying to sell them. Now, again, am I like, do I have some kind of master plan for changing the world? No, but I certainly have a worldview that I'm trying to get across.
Okay.
I'm certainly trying to change people's minds. I'm certainly trying to express a certain truth that I've seen in the world and I'd like other people to be able to see. The thing is, one thing like in the early drafts of the book, when I'm getting kicked around by my editor and friends of mine who I trust to read my work in the early drafts, one of the things I got kicked around for was a suggestion people found in the book that storytellers were Machiavellian, that they were sort of this kind of, ew, these evil laughing, you know, hand rubbing, you know, kind of monster, you know.
I felt a little like that reading it, but I think it's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I backed off, you know, so I tried to back off of that a little bit to try to suggest that, you know, there's nothing necessarily consciously intended as wicked, and also that no one's to be blamed for this. There's no place. Human beings are constantly competing for influence.
Yeah,
that's one of the main things we do. And the reason to be frightened of storytellers is not that they're competing for influence; it's that they're more effective at competing for influence than people who communicate in other ways. So, for instance, you know. We've learned a lot in recent years about just how stunningly, sadly, terrifyingly weak argument based on evidence is at changing how people think and feel. It's really, really quite terrifying.
It's boring.
It's just too boring. It's just too boring. And it just does not, again, it's very good. Like, you know, if, let's say you don't have an opinion on whether like a Weber grill is better than the Sears brand grill, it'll be very easy for you to accept Consumer Reports evidence and argument that you should buy the Weber. Yeah. But if you have a built-in, you know, strong sort of feeling and a strong pre-existing belief about something, it's going to be very, very hard to move you out of your position with argument alone. The only thing that seems to budge people, and even then it's difficult, is a well-told story.
One sentence that stuck out in your book that just I felt really good about. I really liked it. You said, "I know a good metaphor when I see one." I spoke and this podcast hasn't come out yet because I'm working on some music for it. But I talked to Dr. Roger Payne. Do you know Roger Payne? Does that strike a ring a bell to you?
No, but maybe if you told me about him, he would.
Yeah, it may not. It may be a little bit before your time.
Okay.
Roger sort of, I would say he at least popularized, if not discovered, whale songs.
Oh.
And he's, you know, a marine biologist and many other things. And he made a record of it called Songs of the Humpback Whales, which actually is one of Capitol Records' biggest selling records of all time. It was a huge seller and it really sparked the Greenpeace movement. So, you know, if there's a person on earth that is the most responsible for saving the whales, he wouldn't agree with me, but I'm convinced that it's my story is that it's Roger Payne.
Right.
I was trying to get him to do something I'm going to get you to do later, which is give me a creative exercise, you know, for our audience. And his attitude was sort of like, look, we scientists, most of us would probably agree, we've got about 150 years left as a civilization. What we need are stories. We don't need any more science. And he said that. He's like, we're not telling our story. Because the scientists have done, we've done our work for the moment. You're not choking it down. We need artists and we need art to tell the stories. So his version would be the anti-antidote, I guess, which is just fight fire with fire and give people a better story but they're boring. Like even you point out in your book, you know, climate change. I mean, that should be, that's an end of time story. That should be a fucking bestseller. Right. Why didn't we buy that story?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, okay, so climate change is a great story in some ways. In fact, it's a great story in almost all ways. Almost, you can imagine it, and in fact, it has been made into blockbuster fiction over and over again in movies and in best-selling novels and so forth. The problem is that stories need to do two things if you want them to actually sink in. We have to like them. Mm-hmm. And we have to want to view them and want to spread them around and tell their friends about them and sort of spread the meme as widely as possible. But they also have to produce not just emotion, but the right type of emotion. And one of the problems with climate change is no matter how you tell that story, it's a bummer. And people are bummed out and they are negative and they are sad and it feels hopeless. How could we ever solve all the problems associated with climate change in order to save our lives and save the world? And so as much as they might like the story, be thrilled by it, and at the end they're left with something that psychologists call deactivation, emotional deactivation. And when people are deactivated, they want to not jump up off the couch and fight. They want to quit. They want to hide underneath the covers. Yeah. And so we'd have to tell climate change in a very different way. Right. One thing I think we should do, and this is, again, something I'm thinking about right here on the spot, so let's see if it's coherent at all. But I think we should almost drop the environmental aspects of this away. We shouldn't even talk about the environmental impacts. We shouldn't. It turns off Republicans. It turns off exactly the people that need to be convinced, and talk about it only in terms of economics. That this is a huge job program. And oh, by the way, do you want to defeat China or not? Do you want to let China dominate this new era? And this is activating. Suddenly you have an opponent. You have someone to think about in terms of, you know, who's a threat to us and possibly a unifying threat. I think that would be a better way to do it instead of trying to preach to the choir.
Do you think that, like, an inconvenient truth was a deactivator?
It activated a lot of people and deactivated a lot of others.
Right.
The problem is you need sort of a cultural consensus to do anything. Right. In order to get collective action, collective political action, because me doing my recycling does nothing. We need massive, you know, civilization-wide types of changes. And you have to craft a message that is more optimistic, more activating, less politicized, and still achieves the same goal of sucking carbon out of the
atmosphere. And it requires that the kind of people who have been consumed with the data, it's asking them to suddenly turn into the kind of person who will pass around a story with other people. Yeah. If you're really scientifically curious, that would seem to be not the person to tell the story. So it doesn't seem like it's very likely that we're going to adjust and course correct that storytelling anytime soon.
Oh yeah, I agree with you. But you know, your whale scientist friend had a good point.
Yeah,
so I'm not be the guy to tell the story. It should be the artists who are doing it, or, you know, the publicity firms. You know, if you're the scientist, if you're the Sierra Club, I'm sure they've already done this, to be honest, but, you know, you go to a communications firm and you shape communications and you focus group those communications and you see what actually works.
You know, the problem with so many of those types, and this is a problem with topical songwriters over ones that are vague, the difference between Bob Dylan and so many of his peers, is that when someone wants to get a point across, the minute that I know they're trying to jam something down my throat, I turn off. And it's what's so corny about a lot of, you know, what bad kids songs is people think, you know, you're trying to get a kid to eat his spinach and you're singing a song called Eat Your Spinach. He knows you're trying to jam him.
Yeah. So, no, that's one of the most reliable findings in story science, that the moment the people start to detect that they're being messaged, that they're being indoctrinated, then they get skeptical. Then they wake up. The narrative transportation trance is broken. So if you take a show like Will and Grace, which has been credited by a lot of social scientists with this, with kickstarting this incredible transformation of our views toward gay people, and gay marriage in particular, and much more acceptance. How did Will and Grace do that? Will and Grace did almost no indoctrination. They didn't, and it was not heavy-handed. They were not grinding an axe. Their storylines were not like, which hetero bigots are going to come beat up Jack this week. all they had to do was to show likable gay characters living, laughing, joking. And people just said, you know what? I like these people. And they transfer that liking and that sense of warmth and wanting these people to be happy. They transfer it from the characters to gay people in real life. It's very tempting. And I think a lot of storytellers are doing this right now. It's very tempting to grind the axe really hard.
Yeah.
And again, exactly the people you're trying to convince that you most want to bring over to your side are exactly the people who are going to pop out of the trance of narrative transportation and say, wait a second, I see what you're doing. You're just pushing your liberal orthodoxy down my throat in a different way. And I'm turning the channel to Fox News.
That's the reason I think that I was thinking about the call to action stuff that happens on a lot of the really aggressive conspiratorial stuff is that might be, I think this is true. In Iceland, you can't run an ad campaign that calls something the best. Just sort of simple, like if you're anything you're selling, you can't say the best coffee or the best, anything. I'm wondering if maybe one step, people don't like rules, but if one step would be, you have to decouple a call to action from a story, unless it's absolute fiction. That way someone doesn't pick up something and it's like, by the time they get to the end, they're loading their guns and going out to do what they've been told to do, like almost a cooling off period. We're going to tell you the story. We're allowed to do that. It's a free country. Tell the story all you want to. It's fiction, but it has to somehow be decoupled from a call to action. I don't know. Just an idea.
Yeah, hard to enforce, obviously.
Yeah.
What you can hope for, one of the things I hope for also writing the book is, again, sort of a personal responsibility orientation. So more people say, this applies to me. I'm probably as much of a dupe as everybody else to a well-told story. I'm going to try to be more skeptical, more on guard. The other thing I hope for, and this is a more ambitious hope, which would require probably broad readership, which I don't know if I'll get or not, is the establishment of new social norms.
Mm-hmm.
So we start holding each other accountable for the way we tell our stories.
Right.
There's something that I'm especially concerned about and I think is especially dangerous. And I didn't use this language in the book. I did for a while, then I kind of cut it out, but I do in my own head. There's a way of structuring a story, a classic way of structuring a story that almost all stories follow, especially the most influential kind, stuff that really hits broad popular audiences. And I call it the terrific trinary. And the terrific trinary is your story has a hero, it has a victims, and it has villains. And that's a good way of telling a story. It's, every popular story you can think of. That is wonderful. It sometimes has bad spillover effects in fiction, but the terrific trinary becomes, in my head again, the terrible trinary when we start applying that same way of telling stories to complex reality. And so if you have a political narrative in your head, for instance, like here's the good guys, here's the victims, and here's the bad guys, that's a terribly divisive way of telling stories about your fellow Americans. And it doesn't work as messaging. all it does is say, wait, I'm the villain inside your story. Well, I'm not going to live in that story then.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Where I get to be the good guy and you're the bad guy. You know, so I would hope my greatest hope for the book is that social norms get set up where we start enforcing this idea of no terrible trinary
in
narratives of reality.
Let's jump into a voicemail or two, questions or comments about creativity.
Hey, Ben. I'm Mark Hudson from Greenwood, Mississippi. Love your music and your podcast. I learned something with each episode. My question is something I've considered for some time. In the music world, the number of casualties of those with legendary creativity are lengthy and similar. Elvis Presley, Prince, Michael Jackson, Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse, Janis Joplin, Richard Manuel, Billie Holiday, Chris Cornell, and the list goes on. These are only those who died prematurely. Others have difficult lives but haven't died from it. Mm-hmm. My question is this. Do you think exceptional creativity is a hindrance to contentment or happiness? Thank you for your work. Still Fighting It is my song that I relate to as it came out when my son was born.
Thank you
for that and all the others.
Thank you. Well, we happen to have the perfect guest to talk about this today because, John, you addressed this in The Storytelling Animal, I think, if I remember a little bit, which is you can't really ignore how much mental illness there is in artists and generally in great artists. From my perspective, I believe a lot of the intensity behind, because there's two parts of it. There's a career, and that requires a kind of superhuman motivation. So, and then there's the actual finishing of any kind of piece of art. Just simply finishing something requires a little bit of crazy, because it's a huge lift, and you're going into something that by nature seems unfinishable, insurmountable, impossible. And it takes a little bit of delusion to think that you can actually work out of something for which you have no evidence that you could ever get yourself out of. So to me, those two things, like in my personal experience, for instance, the reason my band, probably part of the why we came to some prominence, was because we moved our own baby grand piano into rock clubs, into punk rock clubs for 3 years with no evidence that we'd ever be anywhere. Why that much intensity? Did I need people to love me that bad? why was I going that far? And when it comes to stories that I tell and songs and finishing songs, it does come from an intensity which is partially to make it okay. Like, I want to make things okay when I start to write. My best songs I've written, I think, are songs that came from trying to make something okay. So someone who's like Kurt Cobain, who killed himself, I can only imagine that his intensity to make things okay, and he also had a terrible stomach problem too. He couldn't even really digest food without doubling over on the floor and being ill all his whole adult life. That dealing with that pain, you have someone who's willing to deal with the pain of finishing something. That's the way I view it. I also hate the idea that because an artist is a great artist, that means that they need to be super crazy. And I hate the idea that my favorites are in pain. And I hate the idea that I must be in pain myself in order to finish something. So I've always railed against that. I want to be polite. I don't want to be some crazy person that's on the outside, outsides of society. And personally, I've tried to apply all of my intellect to being normal, civilized person that sits inside civilization, is happy and can write stuff. And I don't know if I buy the myth that both those things can exist. So that's my long answer to that. what have you to say about that?
I relate to it all. I do think, you know, I'm a nonfiction book writer for the most part. As I mentioned, I'm trying to write some fiction also. Nonfiction book writing the art is often concealed. People don't notice it, but there is an art to this stuff. There's a lot of storytelling going on, and there's a lot of craftsmanship built into these things. And I am, during the process of writing these books, when it's intense, up until 5 minutes before this conversation, when I'm nervous and miserable, I'm pretty miserable and crazy during the whole process. This is too hard.
It's misery making.
I've bitten off more than I can chew. I'm not going to meet my deadlines. I'm going to humiliate myself. And I have, since I've, you know, I'm almost 50 now, and I have finally decided I have to find a way to both be productive in my work and be happy. This is this is crucial. And they've never seemed to me mutually possible. We are in a big club. So there's been a lot of argument about this. Well, you know, I can name some people. This, your caller mentioned, you know, Elvis Presley and other people, you know, who had died young or killed themselves, Kurt Cobain. I can mention tons of people who have done the same in literature. You know, Sylvia Plath and Virginia Woolf and David Foster Wallace and Ernest Hemingway blew off his head with a shotgun, and so on and so forth. And people will say, well, that's easy. Those are anecdotes. I can think of many other very well-adjusted artists. Robert Penn Warren, who wrote All the President's Men, and was a three-time Pulitzer Prize winner, twice in poetry, once in fiction. Just a genius and the most psychologically stable person you can imagine. I read his biography recently and
nothing happened. Right. We're not drawn to those. Yeah.
No, not at all. I want that sort of voyeuristic relationship with literary biography of these people living these messy, horrible, lives. But wait, what do you do? You can do a science on it. You can do actual surveys of artists, famous ones and not. And so this sort of science of artistic misery has emerged, and all kinds of dysfunction is overrepresented among creators.
Overrepresented. So really, they're more normal people writing than we.
No.
Healthy. No, the other way.
More mental illness among artists.
Okay. That's what I would think, but yeah.
More alcoholism among artists, more drug abuse among artists, all kinds of bad psychological outcomes, more suicide, much more institutionalization, the levels of things like bipolar disease among poets is something like 7 times the population. It's a vast difference. There's no way it can be just a sampling error or a quirk of the data. This myth of the suffering, tortured artist is no myth at all.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's what I would feel. And I was hoping what you would say is that when you said it's overrepresented, because I hate that idea. I don't like that. I've raged against it. And I would like to, you know, as now in my old age, I would like to be an example of someone who is good and functional. But it wouldn't be honest for me to not admit that I haven't had an easy time. You know, I mean, no one has had an easy time, and I think I come from an upbringing where you don't complain. You try to stay stoic and you don't complain. And I think it's really, I would be very ashamed for people to see my 3 years of sort of putting myself back together with every means that I could because I was afraid I wasn't personally going to make it, because I don't want to be special in that way. And so and I don't want people who create to feel that's romantically interesting. It's fucking boring. It's like, you shouldn't be that way. You should have a good, it's short life. You should have a good life. I spent my 20s not tasting food or wanting to get out of bed. I was I was, that was a bad decade for me. And then if you want to have a worse decade, put yourself on a tour bus and don't sleep but 4 hours a night, which I was going to say a little bit about the Elvis and the people like that. They're also overworked. I can tell you from the music business that what happens is anybody in this audience who has a regular job and sleeps normal hours, who's having a hard time hanging on just with that, I just put permanent sleep deprivation and inconsistent days and diet into it, and that doesn't help you.
Yep. Well, I don't think it's a when I say that there's this correlation between mental illness and artistic creativity, all kinds of mental illness from, you know, normal depression to schizophrenia.
Yeah.
I don't mean for this to be a fatalistic statement for most people. You can learn that you have these susceptibilities. You can get therapy. You can meditate. And you can get older and get wiser.
And your art is a form of therapy as well, which I think is part of the impetus behind high output in someone who's in pain.
Yeah. Well, it's a double-edged sword, though, isn't it? You know, I've often wondered, well, what is my goal in life? Is my goal success or is my goal happiness?
Yeah.
And these are not the same thing. So working really hard and striving single-mindedly towards professional success as a book writer means sacrificing a lot of the things that actually would be conducive to happiness. So I've often wondered, you know, if I was smart, would I just quit? Haven't I done enough? Yeah. I've written these books. They'll be on library shelves after I'm dead, hopefully. Isn't that enough? Let's just be happy. But there's something compulsive about it, and something also positive about the expression, as you said.
Well, you probably are like all of us, wed to the story that that there's going to be misery, and then hopefully right before the end, you'll have a couple of moments of happy, and then the credits roll, and you'll shit the bed.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's the illusion we all live inside.
Yeah, because that's what I tell myself often. It's kind of like, I'll go through the misery of doing these things, and maybe, I don't know, I'll retire. And then I'll be happy. I'll watch squirrels, and I'll sit up on a hill in fucking diapers and hum, you know, and nothing will matter.
Yeah, I have the same. I tell myself that same lie.
Yeah, well, I hate that is a provable scientific statistic about artists, but I have to think that that the art is to a degree also some built-in therapy. And I also feel like some of the best artists are a little less than lucid sometimes. Like when you they're more likely to do either be hermits or do weird things in public that you're like, you didn't get the memo, really. Like you don't understand that's not appropriate. And I actually believe that creativity in itself, to be good at it, has to be to a degree inappropriate. That's part of my belief. So I kind of feel that we are domesticated to the things that we need to live in civilization. Running parallel to that is a gag reflex. It's like, oh, I'd like to just jump on the ground and, I don't know, dry hump the manhole or something like that. I don't want to scream or I want to slap someone in the face. But it's like, no, you can't do that. There's a rule system and it's in your head. But running along next to it are the things that I'm not allowed to think and do in order to create. And I find a lot of people who don't seem to understand what's appropriate or not seem to be really, really creative because they don't have that governor built into their head.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that may be a bullshit. That may be
No. I went and saw stand-up a slate of stand-up comedians this weekend, and you know these are all storytellers, and much of what they're doing is just acting out inappropriate behavior,
right?
Saying things that you can't say, and it's tremendously creative, tremendously artistic, tremendous performers, tremendous writers. But so much of it ultimately comes down to one trick. I will say the things that you're not allowed to say.
Right.
I will pronounce words you're not allowed to pronounce. All those barriers and all those lines that we avoid crossing because we're civilized and polite and we don't want to be ostracized from society, I will run across all of those lines.
I even think that that applies in my sort of half-baked theory, that applies even with appropriate art, because the very act of don't think it, it's like, don't think it. Like, I like the idea that you can think it all and that you can pat yourself on the back for not doing it. I don't know, though, even the word humane or to be human, like that's some amazing thing. We're the worst. Like, we think of doing shit that there's no way dogs think to do some of the disgusting shit that people do. But what I think is cool about people is that that can be running and you can say, nope, I will not do that in this restaurant. And I think that the control over that's awesome. And if you can express that through your art, but don't go humping the leg of a waiter in the restaurant or screaming across the restaurant or eat with your mouth open even. If you can do those two things at the same time, that would seem to be the best.
Yeah, I agree. Although it does concern me that so many artists, including those stand-up comedians I saw this weekend, are more and more concerned about even humping the waiter's leg in their art. You'd like for you to be able to express
something
unexpressible
else.
Notions without feeling intimidated. But in the current political environment, many people feel very intimidated.
And it does come down to don't even think it. And that's a whole other podcast, I think, for us one day, maybe in a year, to come back to, which is all the ways that you allow your social media channels and your computer and your email and your Google searches to get inside your own thinking, the ways that you'll give yourself away. At some point, I won't even want to think it, you know, which is, again... Okay, let's. Can I get a new week's resolution from you, which is, as you've been prepped, is an exercise, a creative exercise for everyone to do for a week that maybe it helps you in your creative endeavors.
Huh? So, what did you call it? A weekly resolution?
I'm calling it new week's resolution. This week, I resolve to do these things, and it'll only last for a week. In the next,
I like new week's resolutions because there's some chance that you might actually keep it.
Right.
I don't know. There's a couple things that I think might be useful to people if you're a creative person, especially for people who are want to write. The most important thing for me is to overcome internal censorship. Of that voice in my head that's saying, you're not very good. You're not very smart. Why should anyone listen to you?
Yeah.
And that sentence you just wrote was really crap. And the next sentence is crap too. And the way I overcome that is through a process that's very common in creative writing and the university context in which I came up. And it's called writing a really shitty first draft.
Mm.
And so the first draft, at least experiment with this. I'll do it. Let's see if I have one right here. I do. So I have a yellow notebook here that I was, in case I need to take some notes during our conversation. And what you see here is the beginning of a really shitty first draft. I do it on paper, and I put my pen down. I'll demonstrate how it's done. I put my pen down, and I go, and I go, and I go, and I go. And I do not allow myself to stop. Even if I'm sort of out of words, I just kind of keep going.
Right.
And I especially don't say, oh, no, that's not quite the right word. That intonation of meaning is just a little bit off. Why don't you go back and edit that? I go and I go and I go and I go and I write this really, and believe me, you have to be prepared to get to the end of it and say, oh, that's a really shitty first draft.
And then great success.
It'll be bad. And I wouldn't even show it to you guys here unless I was fairly clear that my handwriting is bad enough that you couldn't read it. The shitty first draft should embarrass you. But what you'll have then is a mound of raw material, like a big chunk of clay that you can then begin sculpting into something better. Go ahead.
What I like about that is the other thing, the other side of it is no one got killed. Everyone's fine. You wrote something really bad. Oh, well. Right. You haven't avoided that outcome now. Now you're dealing with it and you can live with it.
Well, this is dispelling a great illusion. And the illusion is that great writers, or novelists or nonfiction writers or songwriters like you, are great songwriters. You're not a great songwriter. You're probably not. What you probably are is a great song rewriter.
Right. That's right.
I'm not a great writer. Believe me, you saw that crap. I'm a very diligent, hardworking rewriter. And almost everything that you read started as a really, really bad draft. The stuff that you really like the most, that seems brilliant and inspired, almost none of it was done on the first go. Mostly mm-hmm. went through a hellish process of torturous rewriting and polishing and editing and focus grouping with your friends and trying it out and seeing if it works and then going back to drawing board and so on.
So their exercise is to, you picked up, I have to be specific with them because it's like a class, right? And you're used to that. Are they really going, does it need to be a notebook or can it be a computer?
However they write most fluidly.
Gotcha.
For me, it's I do it this way because on paper, it's kind of harder for me to go back and edit. If right. I'm typing, it's so easy just to click it out and do it again.
So if you're on a computer, you just need to discipline yourself. You're not undoing anything. You're just going to keep going. Yeah. And since it's an assignment, is this about, are you suggesting they do this on something they're currently working on? Or do you suggest that this is its own exercise in creating anything, like almost a throwaway?
Either way, for me, everything that appears in a book like The Story Paradox started out as a really shitty first draft on a yellow notebook
right.
like this.
Well, it ended up as a great book. I loved it. And I had only read another one of your books, which was The Storytelling Animal. And I loved that too. And I would highly recommend, even though I normally don't shill stuff on the podcast, I really think everyone should go out and get both of these books and read them. And thank you very much for taking your time out. I've learned a lot.
It was an honor and truly a pleasure. I it was nothing like my nightmare.
Nothing like your dream. No.
There's no flank steak, nothing.
No flank steaks, and I'm definitely not a Harvard professor or whatever it is you had me being in the. All right. Well, look, let's do it again sometime because there's so much more to talk about. I even wanted to. Let's do one on Noam Chomsky because there is a lecture that by Leonard Bernstein called "The Syntax of Melody." A lecture by Leonard Bernstein, which you can find online.
No, I don't know that.
Next year, listen to that. Let's just talk about that. I want to hear your angles on that. It's really interesting.
Sounds great. Sounds great. Let's do it again.
Awesome. Good to talk to you. Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot.